This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. My guest today is Kristen M. Francine, author of Imagining Musical Pasts, The Queer Literary Musicology of Vernon Lee, Rosa Newmarch, and Edward Prime Stevenson, published by Clemson University Press in 2023. Lee, Newmarch, and Prime Stevenson were active at the end of the 19th and into the 20th centuries. All three were queer, all discussed music both as part of fiction and nonfiction writing, and all worked outside of the academy. Rather than finding a grand unifying theory of early queer musicology, Francine has closely examined three idiosyncratic writers who struggled to stay true to their ideas of intellectual honesty while also writing about music, musical figures, and musical listening in quite different ways. Running through her discussion of each person, Francine meditates on questions of what constitutes historical evidence, what role should gossip and rumor have in nonfiction writing, and what should count as musicology. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, this is great. Thank you for having me, and thank you for reading the book.
it was a joy. Thank you. How did you decide to come across decide to work on this project?
Yeah, so it came out of my dissertation, which I had proposed as a sort of grand unifying theory of late 19th and early 20th century queer writings on music. I thought coming in that I was going to write this sort of huge thesis on how were sexologists talking about music and how were music critics and scholars talking about sexuality. And I realized kind of midway through writing the dissertation that what I had proposed was not a single dissertation. It was more of a career trajectory than a single project. And the research that I had done as I was sort of struggling with that realization had really coalesced around these three people and around their interactions, both with each other's work to some extent, and also with kind of similar issues in 18th and 19th century music. So unfortunately, the planned chapter on Magnus Hirschfeld and the cabaret scene in Berlin sadly had to go. But I think I wound up thinking more about the question of what is musicology, and do these figures who all interacted to some degree or another with kind of pioneering musicological figures, do they count as part of our field?
Well, that does bring me to one of my first questions as I was reading through this. I'm sure that you had more people to choose from, and as you said, you had more topics to choose from than what you wrote. What drew you to these three particular people to write about?
To some extent, I think it was their very different approaches to their own listening practices, whether that was in kind of personal writings, especially in the case of someone like Lee, who kind of made her own listening experiences the center of some of her academic and then quasi-scientific research, or someone like Newmarch, who wrote program notes, or for that matter, someone like Prime Stevenson, who kind of through a variety of very eccentric self-published writings tried to theorize some kind of biographical queer listening into what he was hearing. And I've always been very interested in biography and sort of where is the line between biography and things like biographical fiction and speculation. And that's sort of a theme I think that runs through all three of their writing. And it also got me into thinking of like broader questions of not just how they're using evidence in their work, but also like what constitutes evidence when talking about folks who weren't out in the contemporary sense or who relied very heavily on gossip in their own work. And we really only have a small trace of what they may have talked to other people about.
Well, before we start talking about each individual person, I do want to talk about some of these larger themes that run through the book, just to give our listeners an idea of some of those things that you're thinking about. And one of the things that really struck me was that because of the times that all three of your figures lived in, they were what we would say, you know, none of them were out as in the 21st century viewpoint, of course. And they were dealing with a society that both would have completely stigmatized them had the larger public known about their sexuality. But in two places, they are also women who are dealing with also gender inequality in their professional lives. And I was just wondering what you think, you know, how do you see the tension in all of their lives between needing to keep some important part of their own humanity hidden from most people, and also then trying to talk about music, which is all about, especially in the 19th century sense, all about exploring humanity, right? So how did these figures deal with those issues, do you think, these three people?
Yeah, a big part of it is thinking about the circles in which they moved. So in their public-facing writings, things like Lee's fiction or Newmarch's biographies or Prime Stevenson's newspaper criticism, yeah, they are completely not out, as it were. But within the circles in which they moved, particularly Lee and Prime Stevenson as part of a very sort of close-knit and oftentimes quite homoerotic British expat community in Italy for varying parts of their lives. Among certain friends and colleagues and correspondents, they were more out, and they did write to some extent about what we might consider queer experiences. These last book, Music and Its Lovers, includes discussions of these sort of sound music perception sorts of experiments that she undertook with at least one woman, Anthuser Thompson, Kat, whom she was known to have had a relationship with. Prime Stevenson self-published and privately circulated some very overtly queer writings. So there were avenues for them to make these things a bit more overt among readers and friends that they trusted. I do think Rosa Newmarch raises a really interesting case because she's deeply interested in biography as a form of research. She wrote a number of pieces on Tchaikovsky's life and also translated Modest Tchaikovsky's biography and partial letters. And at the same time, she's very uncomfortable in a lot of her biographical writing with the role of the biographer and the question of how much should we see Rosa Newmarch as the narrator of these stories? And it comes out a bit in the Tchaikovsky project, as I call it. But it's even more overt when she's writing about people who were close personal friends of hers. So her biography of the conductor Henry Wood, or the singer Mary Wakefield, both kind of narratively express a kind of discomfort with the fact that these are people Newmarch knows or knew, and she's mediating their lives. And I think that reflects kind of a sense of privacy in and carefulness in a lot of her writings, in her memoirs, which have only partially been published via a couple of biographies. She's very clearly writing with the intent for future publication. She's not really sharing anything that wouldn't have already been public knowledge as far as her life or career or writings. But she was also, by the same token, very involved with the Society for Women Musicians. And there were folks, most famously Ethel Smyth, being involved in that, whose relationships with women were very well known. So yeah, again, there's the question of if people at the time would have known or suspected things about Newmarch's sexuality and relationships with her companion, Bella Simpson. You know, what exactly would have been known varies by kind of what community you're talking about.
You were talking about Newmarch and her biography of Tchaikovsky and work on Tchaikovsky. And that brings up another topic that you sort of think about throughout the whole book, which is that there's an element. So Tchaikovsky was an important person, you know, important composer of the time. Anyone who's writing about music is probably going to mention Tchaikovsky at some point. And he was a figure that most people assumed was gay, thought was gay. And there was also the Pathetique Symphony, which had this long-standing story about it, that it was biographical and that he committed suicide soon after it was done. And, you know, that it was this sort of queer piece, so to speak. And those rumors about that piece and that very sort of subversive or shocking way of thinking about the Pathetique Symphony, if we're thinking in terms of the turn of the century, kind of turn of the 20th century kind of mindset, each one of these writers, and really any writer from that period, is going to have to deal with, okay, there's a rumor, there's gossip about this person. Yes. What do I do about this gossip? Should this be something I deal with? And then when you're talking about queer people, then you have this sort of other level of, if I talk about it, what might that mean about how people read me? So can you talk about how each one of these people navigated this idea of, what do I do about a queer figure? You know, how do I write about that? What's my responsibility? And then also, what does that mean for each one of these people in terms of what their concerns are about their public-facing writing?
Yeah, so in the case of Lee, I'm thinking of some of the case studies in Music and Its Lovers, where various correspondents, basically people who contributed case studies about their own listening practices to this book, a number of them bring up specific composers and the associations they have with particular composers, whether in terms of kind of emotional content of the music or things they sort of vaguely remember about the composer's biography. And in particular, Tchaikovsky and Wagner come up a fair amount. And part of that is Lee famously strongly detested Wagner's music and thought it was over emotional and, you know, bad influence and all of these things. And so, you know, she was very interested in kind of how other people might experience this. But in the case of Tchaikovsky, there is this discussion of sort of the emotion and the kind of tragic nature of you know, the music. And yeah, she does speculate that some of this Some of this may be in the music, and some of it may be that her respondents are drawing from things they've read about Tchaikovsky, which then leads into, I think, the book kind of comparing how Newmarch and Prime Stevenson treat some of the same evidence, if you want to call it that, or the gossip, as it were, about Tchaikovsky. So Newmarch is very skeptical about gossip as a biographical source in general. She's generally kind of cynical about how much of a person's life we can read into their music. This is very clear in her Grove article about Tchaikovsky. She has this long discussion of what she considers some of his most important works, and is kind of quick to dismiss a sort of easy, you know, Tchaikovsky was depressed, so his music is sad, assumption about something like the Pathétique, and instead kind of puts it on the audience, the listeners, to like, what is it in all of our own experiences that we bring to Tchaikovsky's music that he so successfully draws out in all of us? And this connects to also how she talks about listening in some of her poetry, which potentially does have a more overtly queer subtext. She published two sonnet cycles, both of which feature an ungendered narrator writing about a female beloved, and both of which involve a great deal of discussions of listening to and performing music. And so clearly, regardless of what her personal feelings or identity may have been, thinking about kind of what emotions we bring to the music we listen to was pretty central to how she talks about it. By contrast, Prime Stevenson was very, very into gossip as a historical source. And this makes some amount of sense. He got his start writing for newspapers and as an opera and theater critic, and a writer of short fiction. And around the turn of the century, he inherited a great deal of money from an uncle, and he started self-publishing books about the history of homosexuality. He wrote a novel, Imra, and The Intersexes, which is his sort of big 300-page history of homosexuality, or as he calls it, similis sexualism. And in the section on music, he refers to the gossip that was circulating about Tchaikovsky's death and the Pathétique, and this idea that perhaps he had committed suicide after being blackmailed, which was a very common idea, as you mentioned, particularly in sort of gay urban circles in the Anglosphere. This crops up in a slightly different format in E.M. Forster's novel Morris as well, when the main character goes to a performance of the Pathétique. And so because Prime Stevenson is sort of in these circles that are gossiping about Tchaikovsky, and also because he's drawing very heavily from sexology, his work is very indebted to people like Richard von Krafft-Ebing and Magnus Hirschfeld. And the line between sort of sexological case study and queer gossip in this period is very thin. I think he sees gossip as one way of reading queerness into some of these stories that might otherwise, in his view, be covered up or ignored.
So my other question about the sort of gossip, you really spend a lot of time thinking, you know, as you're saying, about like, how do they use gossip in their writing? But anyone who's studying a queer subject at the turn of the 20th century is, you know, for you as a historian, you also have to deal with this question. Like, what do I do about gossip? Like, were these people actually queer? You know, were they acting upon same sex? You know, were they having sex with someone who was of their same sex or not? Maybe, you know, like, what are their relationships like? And that is very difficult to determine. I mean, like, you're just probably not going to find love letters between two women or two men in this period, or at least not many of them, or, you know, something that would come to the kind of proof that we would take for a heterosexual couple. So what do you think about, you know, how do you use gossip and rumor in your work?
Yeah. So to speak to sort of evidence about these three folks in particular, there is a fair amount of evidence about Lee and Prime Stevenson, letters from them, you know, to various friends, sort of about either relationships that they had or relationships that ended. I'm thinking of, there's a letter that Prime Stevenson wrote to, I believe, a Harvard professor about this younger man that he had this romantic friendship with. And so it's very clear, regardless of what actually happened between them, that there was some kind of very deep emotional connection that Prime Stevenson was kind of mulling over and seeking advice on. So things like that. There's also a long, say, debate in literary biography of Vernon Lee as far as how much her lesbianism influenced both her fiction and her nonfiction writings. So it's a case of, you know, the relationships she's had are fairly well acknowledged, but sort of where is this a collaboration? Where is this a romantic relationship? Where is this both? Are things that seem to come up quite a bit in conversations about her and about how her sense of self, both in terms of her research and her sexuality and her kind of idiosyncratic love of Baroque opera seria, all sort of impacted how she writes about certain things. But something that I really did not expect to write as much about as I wound up writing was how each of these three people, but especially Newmarch and Prime Stevenson, connect to the formation of musicology as a discipline and how much gossip there is in that. So Prime Stevenson, for instance, when he was revising some of his music criticism to turn into a book, or when he was writing his last book on record collecting, like, he sent copies to Music and Letters. Like, he wanted his work to be reviewed by musicologists, even though he was having these books printed in like editions of less than 200. And so, like, nobody was going to find this book and buy it, but he wanted it to be talked about. And he wanted it to be talked about by, you know, people like Fuller Maitland and Edward Dent and, you know, very, very well-known figures in Anglophone music academic circles at this time. At the same time, I think some of the gossip that survives around these people kind of reminds us all that these musicologists in the academy at this moment were also people with their own biases and idiosyncrasies and tendencies towards gossip. There's this great letter in the Library of Congress that Annegret Fauser shared with me, where Edward Dent is writing to Oscar Sonic, the former namesake of the Society for American Music. And Sonic had previously written to Dent asking for his opinion on various British musicologists that might be interested in some kind of collaboration. And so Dent sends this incredibly snarky letter where he lists all of these people and, you know, so-and-so does good work, but, you know, just got married and is off, you know, in his country house. And so-and-so, this composer, will only write about his own music. And he says something along the lines of, Rosa N's only claim to fame is that she reads Russian, but she'll write yards of stuff for you. And then Newmarch is not the only woman that Dent mentions in this letter, although she is one of few. But the fact that this person who doesn't have an academic position and who is writing program notes for the proms and doing a lot of editing of biographies by other people and translation projects, that she's included, if not necessarily complimentary, but like included in this list of important British musicologists, says something about how people active kind of very high up in the field in the early 20th century saw the state of things and saw the participation of figures who were writing for if not the popular press, then sort of music fans or those curious about learning more about music history.
So do you find yourself in your own writing, you know, taking the Rosa Newmarch view and kind of, oh, I don't want to get into that? Or are you feeling like you can use some of that gossip as evidence for your arguments?
It's something I've asked myself a lot, because both this project and other things I'm working on tend to deal a lot with fiction in addition to things like gossip and anecdote that sort of fall between fiction and nonfiction. And yeah, how much can we say about people using either semi-fictional or wholly fictional sources as historical or musicological evidence? By the same token, something I always like to bring up about Newmarch is she was very skeptical about gossip, and she was always quick to tell you that there was no evidence for whatever she had heard or you had heard, or she assumed that you had heard, and she did not believe it, but she always brought it up. So she mentions these autobiographical readings of the Pathétique quite a few times in her work on Tchaikovsky. And she also did a translation of the libretto for Rimsky-Korsakov's Mozart and Salieri, where she does exactly the same thing. She's like, this opera is based on this rumor that's completely untrue, but here are some historical sources that discuss you know, Salieri's rivalry with Mozart. And she's clearly very aware that her readers know or are curious about the sort of juicy stories of music history, because otherwise, why would you even acknowledge that this rumor exists? You know, why would you, you know, claim early on in your biography of Tchaikovsky that the reason he's so popular in Britain is because of the Pathétique, and part of the reason the Pathétique is so popular is because of this story that it's autobiographical and it's, you know, tied to his death. And it's like, well, if you completely discounted the gossip, you wouldn't even bring that up. You wouldn't, you know, even give it the time of day. And so I think as much as Newmarch wants to be a very kind of documentary biographer, she's also very aware that there are these things people are talking about that she can't know for sure, and you know, won't know for sure, especially in the case of Tchaikovsky, where it was known in the early part of the century that there were letters and other documents that the family withheld from biographers and withheld from publication. And so she knew at the time that there were sources she would never have access to. But yeah, I feel like I go back and forth because I am very much someone who wants to know the truth and who can sort of go on perhaps a bit too much about people getting things wrong. But by the same token, I find the appeal of some of this gossip endlessly fascinating. Like Prime Stevenson, I write at length about how badly he wanted Beethoven to have been gay, which is a completely ahistorical reading. I gave a conference talk one time at a meeting about Beethoven biography where I described Beethoven as like a famously heterosexual composer. And so in coming across these pieces in The Intersexes and in Long Hair de Opas, where Prime Stevenson is really trying to do what we would consider a queer reading of some of Beethoven's instrumental music, instead of just saying like this is bad biography and bad music theory, I found myself really wondering, like, well, what is it about Beethoven? And what is it about Prime Stevenson's listening experiences that lead him to these readings? And I think we can ask these questions without necessarily endorsing these, you know, bad history.
Well, let's talk about Prime Stevenson a little bit more. I have to say, of the three of them, I was most drawn to Prime Stevenson. Like, he's the one I really want to have dinner with. So he was you have this sort of interesting way of talking about each of them. You identified a persona from Victorian pulp fiction that you felt like each one of them reminded you of. And for Prime Stevenson, it's the dual or secret identity. So can you tell us, you know, why did you see him as being a good example of that kind of archetype? You know, what about his work or his personal or his life did you feel, you know, that was a good way to think about him?
Part of it is that he very deliberately played with identity in his writings, especially once he starts self-publishing. So his early fiction and his newspaper writing is under variations on his given name, either Edward Stevenson or EIS, his initials, Edward Arrhenius Stevenson. He double barrels his surname after the inheritance. So it was a member of the Prime family, his mother's family, where the money came from. And so after that, he starts referring to himself as Edward Prime Stevenson. And his most overtly queer writings, the novel I mentioned, Imra, and The Intersexes, are printed under the name Xavier Mayne. And at various points, Prime Stevenson, as Mayne, seems to imply some kind of medical credentials, seems to imply that Mayne is in conversation with these people who are like fictional characters in the work. And so on the one hand, there is this pretense that Edward Prime Stevenson, the music critic, and Xavier Mayne, the sexologist, are two different people. And in fact, Prime Stevenson dedicates one of his essays in his book of music criticism to Xavier Mayne, as though he is a different person. And in some of his fiction, references characters as owning some of Xavier Mayne's books as almost like code that these characters are queer. By the same token, while this might seem to be sort of this protective measure to sort of hide the fact that he's writing about this very taboo subject, he doesn't seem to have actually hidden it very well amongst his friends. The copy of The Intersexes that's at the University of Wisconsin, which is the first copy I came into contact with, a former owner of it on the title page, where it says, you know, the intersexes, you know, by Xavier Main, has written in ink in parentheses, probably E.I. Prime Stevenson. And so this was something people in Prime Stevenson's circle talked about. And he apparently, in some of his few surviving letters, seems to have really enjoyed when people guessed who Xavier Main was. But he kept alluding to this. So he submitted a biographical entry on himself to one of the Who's Who reference works, and mentioned something about, you know, also wrote under a pseudonym on a psychiatric subject of great importance or something. So he had this dual kind of authorial identity, but he also like clearly wanted to be able to talk about it. And clearly sought out venues where people would know or suspect. He also mailed copies of some of his works to Magnus Hirschfeld's publication. There are a few kind of collected bibliographies in the Yearbook for Sexual Intermediaries that list some of Prime Stevenson's work, including work that he published under the name Prime Stevenson. So very clearly within this very queer-friendly, sexological academic circle, he was fine kind of crossing those streams. But yeah.
Well, one of the things that really drew me to him was this idea that he was self-publishing these books, sending them to his friends, but then also really publicizing and being outside of this tiny circle. You know, he wasn't really trying to keep it all that hidden, as you said. No. You know, and but there was, so on the one hand, there was this kind of ego thing going on, I think. But on the other, I found in your discussion of him creating what you describe as a queer, or trying to create a queer canon and having these queer readings of pieces and also people that are, you know, Beethoven was really probably not gay. So, you know, he's trying to create this community for himself, for that, where he's that I found quite heartbreaking almost, you know, that he wants this music that speak to him and these composers that speak to him. He wants to have a connection with them. I think that has to do with his sexuality, not just his aesthetic enjoyment of certain pieces. Can you talk about this idea of the queer canon that he was coming up with? Like, what was going on in these projects of his that come closest or are really queer musicology of the time?
Yeah. So I think it's important to say, first of all, that he was not the only person at the time doing this. Composers and music come up a fair amount, particularly in the writings of some of the German sexologists. And there does seem to have been a few people engaging in queer readings of Wagner operas, for example. So another sort of very contested figure, both for his ties to Ludwig II, but also these themes of forbidden love and honor and masculinity in the music dramas. And that's something that definitely comes out in Prime Stevenson's writings about Wagner as well. But I think it's really hard to disentangle his queer sense of self, or what can be extrapolated from sort of personal allusions and suggestions in some of his works, and his aesthetic preferences, because as much as I would like love to sit down and talk to him about some of the stranger elements of his writing. He was also, in many ways, terribly elitist. He hated jazz because it was not at all what he was about. You know, you might dance to it. It was more about the body than this sort of like emotional, quasi-religious listening experience. He disliked the radio because you as the listener didn't have control over the particular piece of music that you listened to. Whereas with the gramophone, with records, you know, you were choosing which movement of a symphony or an opera or whatnot you wanted to hear in the privacy of your home. So some of his musical preferences are in some ways what we would expect from like an upper class white male music critic active in the 1890s and who lived into the 1930s and 40s. By the same token, in the passage in The Intersexes, where he talks about a queer reading of Beethoven's Opus 111 piano sonata and sort of conflates that work with Tchaikovsky's Pathétique and suggests some biographical similarities between them. The other composers he brings up in that section, Wagner, Brahms, and Bruckner, all of these people, you know, were writing the kinds of music he liked. He really liked symphonies and to some extent opera. Although I think he often had more to say about symphonic music than he did about sort of individual operas. All of them had very complicated, I think it's fair to say, romantic lives, whether that's in their relationships with women or in their relationships with friends of theirs, kind of regardless of gender. And so I think because there are these unknowns biographically, as far as not necessarily sexuality, but you know, what's really going on in, you know, something like The Immortal Beloved Letter or something like, yeah, Wagner's interactions with King Ludwig, or, you know, Brahms's relationship with Clara Schumann. There are these big unknowns that may or may not be queer, but they're definitely something where someone who's very interested in history and biography and gossip and also in listening to music can sort of sit with music by these people and imagine like some kind of secret knowledge. And I think that was really what appealed to Prime Stevenson in shaping the particular composers that he reads queer either text or subtext into, is that there is this room for imagination and speculation.
Well, I think that it's so interesting because that, you know, just listening to pieces of music and finding a narrative in it where the composer never suggested there was a narrative is a way that many people in the 19th century heard music. We have reams and reams of writing about music where this is a stream and here's the fawn and, you know, like, yes. And now this is happening, you know, and it's raining or whatever. And so this idea that there is always a secret subtext to especially instrumental music was commonplace. But what is interesting to me is that he is hearing it in this very specific way that was not a mainstream way of finding meaning in this music. And it's got to have some kind of biographical relationship to his own life that he's hearing this music in this way.
Right. And I think this is what he's struggling with, is that he is a person who, you know, in New York in the 1890s when he's doing his theater criticism and that the stuff he writes for the newspapers is fairly typical, you know, reviews of performances and kind of who was there and, you know, what the orchestra sounded like and what the singer sounded like. And it's, I think once he's has the financial means and the connection with printers to be able to sort of do this on his own outside of the newspaper world, I think what he's struggling with is that he wants to bridge these two things. He wants to use the ways of thinking about music that he clearly kind of grew up in and was immersed in his professional life, with both his own sexuality and also what he's been able to connect with sexology and other early 20th century queer authors. He wants to be able to do all of this, which is why I think about him as sort of a proto either queer musicologist or queer music theorist, because when he's looking at particular pieces and wondering about potential biographical meanings, like, I think that's something we often wonder about when we're thinking about, musical evidence is, yeah, how much can we use a piece of music as evidence of something in whether it's the composer's life or a performer's life or the librettist's life, any number of things. And I think we're rightly very wary of biographical readings, particularly as you say, when they don't come from anything confirmable in the composer's life. But by the same token, this has also been something, people have been doing with heterosexual relationships in music history. I'm thinking of, all of the people various biographers have proposed, did Mozart have affairs with these singers because he wrote these arias for them? Or, these sorts of things that there's sort of equally dubious or circumstantial evidence for that get taken much more seriously in biography, and particularly in biographies at this time. You get these books like Love Lives of the Great Composers that are very much these sorts of things when it comes to sort of male composers with female muses and the like. And I think, yeah, Prime Stevenson's looking at the music and the history available to him and wondering like, well, where can I go with this?
Well, I mean, it is true. I think we often require a level of proof about if two people are having a gay relationship that we do not require for proof for a straight relationship, for sure. I want to turn to Vernon Lee. We've talked a fair amount about Rosa March, Newmarch already, but not as much about Vernon Lee, who's the first person you talk about in the book. You call her the ghost hunter, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit about her as a person, since we really haven't discussed that at all. And then, what about why are you calling her the ghost hunter?
Yeah, so Vernon Lee fascinates me as someone who really like knew from a very young age she wanted to write about music and art history. And so she came from a very well-off family and was essentially given this amazing education in art history and largely as a teenager and a young woman, like largely self-directed study, as it were. Her first book, Studies in the 18th Century in Italy, was published when she was in her 20s, and she very much wrote about it later in life as kind of a first book where she was ambitiously trying to do everything, so maybe a bit like a dissertation. But she, as she explored Italian artistic history, and she found this very intense fascination with 18th century opera and the castrati in particular. And so while she she doesn't overtly talk about the castrati as queer. Of course, she wouldn't have used that term anyway, even if she did. But she's clearly very fascinated with these accounts of these great singers who sort of exist, in her view, almost outside of society and have these, you know, great, you know, musical powers attributed to them and, you know, sing roles that kind of cross gender lines. And so she returned to this subject quite a few times in this kind of monumental book, which is theoretically about the 18th century in Italy, but like a great deal of it is about opera stereo. And also in a short story called The Wicked Voice, that is also a very early work of hers, that is her clearly working through her own musical tastes and interests. And so she sets up this character in A Wicked Voice called Magnus, who is this kind of strutting Wagnerian composer who hates 18th century music and hates singers for some confusing reason, and is wandering around Venice, you know, trying to finish his next great opera, and finds himself overwhelmed, perhaps supernaturally, by what seems to be the ghost of a castrato. And this is part of what I talk about Lia's, the ghost hunter, was because she wrote a number of stories involving ghosts, either kind of literal apparitions or these sorts of psychological encounters with figures across history. But part of it is also because of how much of her work, both her fiction and nonfiction, was about sort of these speculative encounters with the past in ways that sometimes seem to resonate with how people in the latter decades of the 19th century, in some cases, were talking about like actual ghost hunting. So the Society for Psychical Research, you know, these kind of scientific or quasi-scientific bodies that were seeking to explore what the existence of ghosts. And some of it was more just how much of a role imagining a connection between sort of her as the author and these other personalities play in her research. And so in Studies of the 18th Century, there's this very vivid scene where she talks about like walking through a portrait gallery in a conservatory and seeing all of these sort of powdered wigs and very dour kind of 18th century portraits. And, you know, some of the composers and singers are names we recognize and some of them are forgotten. And she's clearly imagining this connection with the subjects of these portraits, and in a way that isn't, you know, literally depicted as supernatural, but is this kind, has this sort of ghostly quality where she feels she's kind of looking back in time and across some sort of barrier with these figures.
So we should probably start wrapping up. So I want to end with one more kind of 30,000 foot question, and that is, you do posit that though all three of these writers were primarily writing for a sort of a general audience, or in the case of Prime Stevenson, some of his work, he's writing for a very small sort of self-selected audience to a certain extent, and none of them had academic appointments. You posit that all of these people should be counted as musicologists and that what they are doing is musicology. So can you talk a little bit about like what is musicology? Why do you think that these are musicologists? Can you sort of finish with this sort of grand statement about that?
Yeah, I feel like my very glib answer is musicology is what musicologists do. But I feel like we're all used to that sort of thing. I think what's important for me about all three of these people is much like we can't know if, you know, if plopped into 2024, if they would all identify as queer, or what labels, if any, they would use. It's also unclear to me, to varying degrees, how much any of them would sort of freely claim the title of musicologist. But I think what is important is that all of them in their work raise questions that are still important to musicologists today, whether it's about historical interpretation, whether it's about the role of biography in musicology, whether it's about how kind of queer analysis or queer theory, if we want to call it that, might fit into musical analysis. Like none of these things are questions we've solved in 2024. And I think looking at these folks who are grappling with some of these issues in a context where they don't necessarily have a clearly established academic framework, and they certainly don't have, you know, institutional academic support to do this research, I think it just gives us a bigger picture of where some of these questions we're still asking come from, and how people have been wrestling with them for longer than we might think.
So you have finished a big project here, going all the way back to grad school. What are you doing now?
Yeah, starting book number two. So I am starting a new research project, building on some of the theorizing around gossip and fiction in music history. And I'm working on what will hopefully be a new book, looking at the role of gossip and anecdote and sometimes just outright fiction in Antonio Salieri's reception history. So starting in 1823 with a number of newspapers that prematurely report his death, and sort of how questions of legacy and life writing appear at the very end of his life, and going through the 200th anniversary of his death next year, I'm sort of tracing how things that perhaps start out as gossip or speculation in the newspapers and the popular press find their way into both fiction. So most famously things like Mozart and Salieri and Amadeus, but also sometimes how they find their way into nonfiction, and how long it can take before sort of the interactions between fiction and nonfiction and semi-fiction are really acknowledged.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project. And really, I love the idea of how do historical myths actually become a myth? You know, how does it infiltrate not only, as you say, fiction, but then becomes fact in some ways as it shows up in kinds of venues where you're assuming that there's some peer review going on.
So
that sounds absolutely fascinating. Well, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your book. My name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. And I've been talking with Kristen M. Francine, author of Imagining Musical Pasts, The Queer Literary Musicology of Vernon Lee, Rosa Newmarch, and Edward Prime Stevenson, published by Clemson University Press in 2023. Thank you so much.
Thank you.